Section 13 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 4, Ethic, Part 1. Beauty, the eternal spouse of the wisdom of God, an angel of his presence through all creation, fashioning her new love realm in the mind of man, attempteth every mortal child with influences of her divine supremacy. Even as in a plant, when the sap mounteth secretly, and its wintry stalk breaketh out in a prolific miracle of spring, or as the red blood floodeth into a beating heart, to build the animal body comely and strong, so she, in her transcendent rivalry, would flush his spirit with pleasurable ichor of heaven. And where she hath found responsive faculty, in some richly favoured soul,
l'anima vaga delle cose belle,
hath saith the Florentine, she will inaugurate her feast of dedication, and even in that earliest onset, when yet infant desire hath neither goal nor clue to fix the dream, even then, although it graspeth naught,
and passeth in its airy vision away, and dieth out of remembrance,
'tis in its earnest of life and dawn of bliss purer, and hath less of earthly tinge than any other after attainment of the understanding. For all man's knowledge kenneth also of toil and flaw, and even his noblest works,
though they illume the dark with individual consummation,
are cast upon by the irrelevant black shadows of time and fate. Hence is the fascination of amateurs in art, who, renouncing accomplishment, attain the prize of their humbler devotion, as Augustine saith, that fools may come at holiness where wise men miss. Facit enim hoc quidam etiam stoliditas. Arriving by shortcoming, like to homely birds of passage, nesting on the roofs of the workshops. And though of secret knowledge man's art is compact, yet not the loving study of any masterwork, nor longest familiarity, can ever efface its birthday of surprisal. And great music, to me, is glorified by memory of one timeless hour when all thought fled, scared, from me in my bewilderment. See, then, the boy, in first encounter with beauty, his native wonder awakened by the motion of love, as when, live air, breathing upon a smothered fire, shooteth the smouldering core with tiny flames.
So he kindleth at heart with eternal expectancies,
and the dream within him looketh out at his eyes. 'Twas through worship of Christ that this thing came to men, whereat, when art achieved portrayal of tenderness, the Christian painters thronged their heaven with cherubims, little amorini, who, with rebel innocence, dispossessed the tall angels. And Mary's young babe cast off his swaddling bands and stood up on her lap in grace of naked childhood for the image of God. But as 'tis with the race, for which our hope draweth its only assurance of its high nobility from rare examples, holy men and wise, revered even by the common folk, that none the less pursue their common folly interminably, and more pamper despair that is the giant sorrow of earth. So in the child this glimpse or touch of imminence, being a superlative brief moment of glory, is too little to leaven the inveterate lump of life, and the instincts whose transformed vitality should lust after spiritual things return to their vomit and wallow in the mire of their animal ruts. Nature hath something truly of her promise in all, yet in the infinite disposition of random seeds her full potency is rare, as in the end of his book that maketh the old school benches yet to sprout in green, Aristotle confesseth, where the teacher saith virtue cannot be taught to a mind not well disposed by nature, and he that hath that rarest excellence,
diatinos theias aetias,
may be above all men styled truly fortunate, and with those four Greek words hath proudly pricked to virtue many a sluggard soul. Forsooth, the need of fortune stayeth not here, alas! There is no assurance of stability or fair growth unless she stand by faithfully and foster the soul, fending from all evil and encompassing with good, the while these intimations come to be understood and harmonized by reason in the conduct of life. Now, as reason matured to the power of manhood, tutored by discipline of nature, and ordering the accumulated scrutiny of physical flux in various sciences, so education of spirit, in the dignity of its creative enthusiasms, and honourable intelligence of God's gifts, mapped out its own science of conduct, aligning a pathway of happiness through the valley of death, and that science, called ethic, dealing with the skill and manage of the charioteer in Plato's myth, rangeth up here in place for the parley of this book. Since all ethic implieth a sense of duty in man, 'tis first to inquire whence that responsible ought arose, a call so universal and plain-spoken that some have abstracted a special faculty, distinct from animal bias and underrivable, whereby the creature kenneth the Creator's will, that, in stillness of sound speaking to gentle souls, dowereth all silence with the joy of his presence. But to men savage or superstitious, a voice of horror, maleficent, inescapable, hounding them with dreadful conviction of sin, as when Adam in Eden hid from the scour of God's eye. Which old tale of displeasure is true to life, because the imperative obligation cannot be oversummed,
being in itself the self-conscience of that essence, which is no other indeed than the prime ordinance that we call law of nature.
In its grade, the same with the determined habit of electrons, the same with the determining instinct of unreasoning life, necessity became conscient in man, whereto all insubordination is imperfection in kind. Reality appeareth in forms to man's thought as several links, interdependent of a chain, that, circling, returneth upon itself, as doth the coiled snake that in art figureth eternity. From universal mind the first-born atoms draw their function, whose rich chemistry the plants transmute to make organic life, whereon animals feed to fashion sight and sense, and give service to man, who, sprung from them, is conscient in his last degree of ministry unto God, the universal mind, whither all effect returneth whence it first began. The ring in its repose is unity and being. Causation and existence are the motion thereof.
Throughout all runneth duty, and the conscience of it is that creative faculty of animal mind, that, wakening to self-conscience of all essences, closeth the full circle, where the spirit of man, escaping from the bondage of physical law, re-entereth eternity by the vision of God.
This absolution of reason is not for all to see, but any man may picture how duty was born, and trace thereafter its passage in the ethic of man. There is a young black ouzel, now building her nest under the rosemary on the wall, suspiciously shunning my observation as I sit in the porch, intentive with my pencil, as she with her beak. Could we discourse together, and were I to ask for why she is making such pother with that rubbishy straw, her answer would be, surely, I know not, but I must. Then could she take persuasion of reason to desist from a purposeless action. In but a few days hence, when her eggs were to hatch, she would look for her nest, and if another springtide found us here again, with memory of her fault, she would know a new word, having made conscient passage from the must to the ought. I halt not then, nor stumble at how the duteous call was gotten in course of nature. Rather it lieth to show how it was after-shapen in man from physical to moral ends, and came no longer only to affirm but sometimes even to oppose the bidding of instinct, positing beside ought the equivalent ought nots, the stern forbiddances of those tables of stone that Moses fetched out of the thunder of Sinai. And since we see how man's judgment of right and wrong varieth with education, and that without effect to strengthen or weaken duty, we conclude therefrom that education sharpeneth our moralities, and when and whereas conscience transfigureth the instincts to affection, as aforesaid, from motherly selfhood, and to spiritual love from lust of breed, we find duty therewith extended in the moral field. 'Tis thus, as missionaries tell, that headhunters, who seek relish in refinement of cruelty, will yet to soft feelings respond a gentle appeal. My dog would do as well, could he understand my speech. Yet though we see how birds in catering for their young stint not their self-devotion, and punctiliously observe distributive justice, and that dutiful dogs, urged by conflicting calls, will stand a while perplexed in dumb deliberation. Nevertheless, because the true spiritual combat is unknown to brutes, moralists teaching virtue, as an end in itself, repudiate any sanction from motives engaged on animal welfare, and make utility a cant term of reproach, though on their higher plane, spiritual conduct also is utilitarian. For virtue subserveth the soul's comfort and joy, therewithal no less useful, nay more requisite, than is material comfort to our full happiness in self-realization of perfected nature, the which a sound doctrine of pleasure will confirm. Denial of use hath done our virtue wrong, while some belittle also our ethic, saying the subject is of matter unacknowledgeable in scientific sense, taking contingency from the imperfection of man. Granted, were all men perfect, none would seek virtue, nor should I now debate of it, but neither again were all omniscient, would any seek knowledge. Yet go we hunting after truth insatiably, as the saints after holiness, who, comforted by least attainment, persevere, seeking the Lord whom they have found. And if a check or fault show more in ethic, 'tis that the hunter is on fuller cry after true happiness than after mental truth, or he thinketh at least to have well nosed his desire, and he nameth his quarry satisfaction of soul. Whereas of absolute truth, whatever that may be, or is, he hath not an inkling, nay, nor any cause, save in spiritual faith, even to hope well of it. 'Tis for such lack of stand that deep thinkers, who plot intellectual approaches to the unknown, will lean unconsciously upon ethic, or in the end incline graciously towards it. Now, any deficiency is more discernible in an object known than in a thing unknown to us, and in the discussion of it there is better likelihood of agreement. Although good disposition, as Aristotle hath it, may be by beauty educated and aspire to theoretic wisdom, as Plato would teach, and ethic therewithal claim honour of the same rank that ideal philosophy ascribeth to man, yet, if for lack of faith he sink that claim, I see a thing of hap without place in reality. On no hand is't denied that terms of right and wrong are wholly pertinent to man's condition on earth, nor that, whatever his destiny may be, his origin was bestial, and his first ethic a rudiment, that shifting ever and shaping in the story of man, at every time is the index of his growth in grace. And if the change of customs that the herd adopt, for comfort, and to ensure what they most value in life, hath moral tendency upward, then that tendency is the animal sanction of virtue, and will take honour as such. But duty instilled with order is so almighty of kind, that 'twill make law of habit, whence all social codes outlast their turn and time, and, in arrear of life, hold the common folk backward from their nobler vaunt, lagging and dragging, whether as a garment outgrown, tattered, and foolish, or as strong fetters and chains, wherein they lie fast bound in misery and iron. Hence cometh all the need and fame of teachers, men of inborn nobility, called prophets of God, saviours of society, seers of the promised land, that white-filleted company that Aeneas found circled round Musaeus in the Elysian fields, the loved and lovable, whose names live evermore, the sainted pioneers of salvation, unto whom all wisdom won, and all man's future hope is due. And with inspiration of their ampler air, we see our ethics split up sheer and sharply atwain. Two kinds diverse in kind there be, the one of social need, lower, still holding backward in the clutch of earth, from old animal bondage unredeemed, the other, higher and spiritual, that with personal affiance with beauty hath made escape, soaring away to where the ring of being closeth in the vision of God. Sticklers for equality will hear naught of this, arguing that social is but a past personal, personal a future social, tenses of one verb, the amatum and amabo on the stem of love, virtue's pure native stock, which hath no need of graft. A doctrine, kindly at heart, that cajoleth alike diffidence of the ruler and conceit of the crowd, who in collusion float its credit, and awhile their ship of state runneth like a yacht in the race, that with full bellying sail, for lack of seamanship, seemeth to forge ahead, while it loseth leeway. No politic admitteth, nor did ever admit, the teacher into confidence, nay, even the church, with hierarchy and conclave compassing to install St. Peter in Caesar's chair, and thereby win for man the promises for which they had loved and worshipped Christ, relaxed his heavenly code to stretch her temporal rule. For social ethic, with its legalized virtue, is but in true semblance, alike for praise or blame, a friendly domestication of man's old wolf foe, the adaptable, subservient, gentlemanly dog, beneath groomed coat and collar, in his passion unchanged. Thus 'tis that levellers, deeming all ethic one, and for being socialists, thinking themselves teachers, can preach class hatred as the enlightened gospel of love. But should they look to find firm scientific ground whereon to found their creed in the true history of social virtue and its progress hitherto, 'twill be with them in their research, as 'twas with him who yesteryear sat down in Mesopotamia to dig out Abraham's birthplace in the lawn graveyard of Asian monarchies, and low hummocks of dust betray where legendary cities lie entombed, Chaldean Kish and Ur, while for all life today poor nomads, with their sparse flotilla of swarthy tents and slow sand-faring camels, cruise listlessly o'erhead, warreners of the waste. Now this man duly unearthed the walls whence terror flitted, but beneath those walls more walls, and the elder buildings of a dynasty of wider rule than Abraham knew, a nation extinct ere he was born, wherethrough, sinking deeper their shafts, the diggers came yet never on virgin soil, but still wandering on earlier walls, arches and masonry, a city and folk undreamt of in archaeology, trodden under ere any story of man began. And there, happening on the king's tomb, they shovelled from the dust the relics of that old monarch's magnificence, drinking vessels of beaten silver or of clean gold, vases of alabaster, obsidian chalices, cylinder seals of empire, and delicate gems of personal adornment, earrings and finger-rings, craftsmen's tools, copper and golden, and for music a harp. Withal, in silver miniature, his six-oared skiff, a model in build and trim of such as ply to-day Euphrates' flowery marshes. All his earthly toys gathered to him in his grave, that he might nothing lack in the unknown life beyond, but find ready to hand his jewelled dice and gaming board and chamber lamp, his toilet box of paints and unguents. Therefore 'twas the chariot of his pride whereon he still would ride was buried with him. There lay yet the enamelled film of the inlaid perished wood, and all the metal gauds that had embossed the rail, animal masks in gold, wild bulls and lions, and twin-figured on the prow, great panther heads to glare in silver o'er the course, impatient of their spring, and one rare masterwork, whose grace the old warrior wist not should outlive the name and fame of all his mighty doings, when he set it up, that little native donkey, his mascot on the pole. 'Twas he who dug, told me of these things, and how, finding himself a housebreaker in the home of men who 60 years afore, when they left life, had sealed their tombs from sacrilege, and there had lain, till from the secrecy of their everlasting sleep he had torn the coverlet, his spirit, dazed awhile in wonder, suddenly was stricken with great horror, for either side the pole, where lay the harnessed bones of the yoke-mated oxen, there, beside their bones, lay the bones of the grooms, and slaughtered at the post all the king's bodyguard, each liegeman's spear in hand, in sepulchred attention. And whereby lay the harp, the arm-bones of the player, as there she had plucked her dirge, lay mingled with its fragments, and nearby, disposed, two rows of skeletons, her sisterly audience, whose lavish ear-pendants and gold-filleted hair, the uniform decoration of their young service, marked them for women of the Hadim, sacrificed to accompany their lord, the day when he set forth to enter into the presence of the sceptred shades, congregated with splendour in the mansions of death. Leave Tigris now, and seek out our Aryan race, by Gunga and Hydaspes in the teeming realm where Sakyamuni preached of gentleness and love, and took divinity before Christ came. See how, at every Raja's pyre, in Punjab or Kashmir, in Vijayanagar, Kalikata, and Udaipur, for long-lived centuries the mild Hindus have burnt their multitudinous girl concubines alive, and still beneath our lax imperial rule will deem any honest outlawry of their ritual sati a tyrannous impiety of our western manners, which none the less withheld not of our island kings the last Henry, styled first defender of the faith, from slaying his wives at will. Nor was he for such crime less esteemed of the folk, although judged as a man, by pagan ethic or Christian, or by the insight of poet or historian, more despicable than we need to suppose that old monarch of Ur. See how cross-eyed the pride of our worldwide crusade against Nigerian slavery, while the London poor, in their Victorian slums, lodged closer and filthier than the outraged alien. And under liberty's name our industry is worse fed and shut out from the sun. In every age and nation a like confusion is found. End of section 13.